Hi, Mark. How are you today?
Hello, Joshua. How are you?
Good. So we haven't talked before on Blogging Heads TV. In fact, we've never talked
before. We're all, right?
Ever. So it's nice to meet you in this attenuated sense of meet. Let's introduce ourselves, though. I'm Josh Cohen. I teach political science, philosophy, and law at Stanford University, and I'm editor of Boston Review.
And I'm Mark Kleinman. I teach public policy at UCLA and blog at the Reality Based Community. Well, that's probably a good number. Oh, and I edit the Journal of Drug Policy Analysis.
Yeah. You get free samples.
Huh?
You get free samples.
I don't. A friend of mine who was in the serious drug research business. You know, working on neuroreceptors in animals. So, you know, the problem with doing drug research is that all the good stuff goes to the rats.
Right. Yeah. Well, I teach philosophy, so I just get free ideas.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So we were going to start off by just saying a few things about the issue of Haiti, a topic on which neither of us has any expertise at all, but it's
right. And the primary thing to say is, ain't it a shame what's happening in Haiti?
It's hard to, and more than a shame, I saw some pictures this morning, which really, I have to say, I mean, they looked like what pictures of the end of the world look like. Just piles of bodies in ditches. Really terrible.
I've been a coward. I've just been reading as little about it as I can.
Yeah. Well, these were bracing. I had looked at other pictures before, but the only pictures that I had ever seen like this were pictures of kind of Holocaust pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't ever say that kind of thing.
Right.
This was really sort of startling and awful. And it prompted me to do what I'm sure probably everybody listening has been doing, which is to provide some more support. And in my case, I've been supporting Partners in Health, the Paul Farmer organization in Haiti. And I think people should give to whoever they feel comfortable about giving to, and it's hard to define kind of principles about who you're going to give to. Anybody who's going to help out, I think, is worth giving to. I do think that there are a few reasons for that personally I pick Partners in Health, and one is that they have a lot of capacity in the country already. Secondly, this is not a disaster relief NGO that's going to come and go. There's part of the Partners in Health enterprise is to build healthcare capacity in the country through local participation, not just in Haiti but in all their projects. And also they work closely with the Ministry of Health. And since looking forward from this, it's I'm sorry, there's something
sorry, yeah,
on the line. Looking forward from this, you certainly want to be concerned about building capacity and remedying some of the institutional deficiencies that have contributed to making this as horrible a human disaster as it's been. And I think Partners in Health has a project of that kind. But as I say, I think my attitude about this is that people should just focus on the incredible destruction and the human vulnerability that it's revealed, and not use this as an occasion for defending a political position. And, a few people have done that. I mean, Limbaugh was the most extreme example of it. But there was I've seen some things from people on the left who will say things like, why are people making such a big deal out of providing assistance for Haiti? Of course we should do that. We owe it to them because of all the destruction we've done there in the past. And I also think that kind of thing this is not the time for that kind of thing either. There was a Bill Kristol piece that was in national standard about, you know, very strongly supporting the efforts of the Obama administration to move on this issue, but then also using it as an occasion to say, you know, this is why we need a big military budget. Just
what?
Bad timing, I think.
A big military budget because the military is the only thing that can deliver disaster relief?
That seemed to be the argument, that it's nice to have this tool around, and the tool could be used for all sorts of purposes, including deployments of this kind. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. True or false? My sense is false, but true or false, it just seemed to me to be the wrong time to be delivering that kind of message. I thought the tone that was struck by Clinton and Bush the other day, was more appropriate.
Okay, I hear that.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, you know, if you don't use a disaster to focus your attention on what's important, then it never gets focused. I think the discussion with Crystal, I didn't read his piece.
Yeah.
But the discussion with Crystal about whether what this demonstrates is that we need a bigger military because they're the only ones who can actually land in Haiti and get stuff done, or whether this demonstrates what a catastrophe it is that we let Jesse Helms wreck the State Department, NAID, so they don't have that capacity. It's not as if there's anything essential to the military way of life that makes them uniquely fit to do this. Just they've got a big budget.
To the contrary, there might be some things that make them, you know, not the ideal.
Right. I mean, presumably you want some of both. I mean, you know, nobody else is going to have that many helicopters.
Right.
We're seeing the same thing in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
That we've got the military doing stuff that would be better for somebody else to do because there's no other capacity.
Right.
I forget who it was who said that the U.S. government is now basically a pension fund with an army.
Right. Just on the Afghanistan thing, we should, having announced that neither of us is expert on Haiti, we should not pretend to be. I just think that this is not the time for having those discussions. But just one point on the Afghanistan issue, which there is something analogous on that. There is a report that was done by some military intelligence guys that was published on the Center for New American Security January, just a couple of weeks ago. 8 years into the war in Afghanistan, the U.S. intelligence community is only marginally relevant to the overall strategy,
right,
having focused the overwhelming majority of its collection efforts and analytical brain power on insurgent groups. The vast intelligence apparatus is unable to answer fundamental questions about the environment in which U.S. and allied forces operate and the people they seek to persuade.
Right.
Ignorant of local economics and landowners, hazy about who the power brokers are and how they might be influenced, incurious about the correlations between various development projects and the levels of cooperation among villagers, and disengaged from people in the best position to find answers, whether aid workers or Afghan soldiers, U.S. intelligence officers and allies can do little but shrug in response to high-level decision-makers seeking the knowledge, analysis, and information they need to wage a successful counterinsurgency. This is, by the way, this is written by, among others, the Major General Michael Flynn, who is was Deputy Chief of Staff for Intelligence for the International Security Assistance Force in has that position in Afghanistan, part of the McChrystal team. So this is
the Army talking about the CIA, essentially.
This is the Army saying that we don't have the informational capacity to run counterinsurgency, and we better do something different.
Right.
And they won't, but that's another matter.
Actually, there's just a story in the paper about some major who sort of decided to be Lawrence of Afghanistan. Going in actually, you know, figuring out who the relevant elders are, tribe by tribe.
Right. We should just one more footnote on this and then proceed along. There's the problem is that the ideas about counterinsurgency strategy that are being written now are largely based on studies of counterinsurgency that were done under colonial regimes. And all the successful stories about counterinsurgency, to the extent that there are any, were counterinsurgencies that were fought by colonial in cases where there was a long history of a colonial regime.
Basically, the list of successes is Malay and Philippines, right?
Right. So Malay is the big example. And the thing is, when you're fighting a counterinsurgency and you're a colonial regime, you have people whose day job it is to know this stuff about
right.
what's happening. I mean, I'm not defending colonial counterinsurgencies, but this is right. the job of district officers in mm-hmm. Colonial regimes. What I think is interesting about this fixing intel mm-hmm. report that came, as I say, from the Center for New American Security, is that they're basically saying we have to compensate for the fact that we don't have anything like district officers around who know anything about the countries that we're operating in. I don't think that that's going to happen. I don't think that there's going to be any success in doing that. But I think this brings us to.
On that point. So, yeah. One of the ideas that was around Washington a year ago mm-hmm. was to shift the resource balance from defense to state, and build up some real capacity in the State mm-hmm. Department. And the assumption that it's the CIA that should know what the political structure is of Helmand. This is not obvious.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's also what FSOs are about.
Right.
And AID workers. And so part of the reason that Jack Lew was brought in as a second deputy Secretary of State was he was going to be the management guy to build up the management capacity at State that would then support a big increase in resources. Now, I don't know, you know, what progress. That's the kind of project where you don't know what progress is being made until it's actually worked.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's, you know, at least the Obama administration early on had spotted the problem. And by the way, this does take us back to Haiti in the sense that, you know, I mean, a 7.0 earthquake, you know, doesn't lead to, you know, the end of the world in a competently run country. And I think this is as good a time as any to say, look, the problem with Haiti is that it's ill-governed. And we've never figured out how to help with that. And the least we should expect out of the rescue effort is that we not make things worse.
We certainly don't want to make things worse. I'm a little suspicious about claims that we're going to be able, through this effort, to improve the governance. Although, as I say, I think there is an issue about who you choose to give money to, and I think
right.
some organizations, and I do think this is true about Partners in Health, are more likely to help out over the long term because
right.
they've been there and have the relevant on-the-ground experience. But maybe we should talk about how we're governed, speaking of being governed.
Oh, that's just too depressing, isn't it?
It is depressing, yeah.
There is actually cheerful piece of news. Yesterday, Joe Biden said, no democracy has ever survived with supermajority rules, and the current use of the filibuster basically converts it into a supermajority rule, and we need to get rid of that. And if he follows through on that, that's the most important thing I've heard in years. And all we need is a ruling from the vice president at the beginning of the next Congress
yeah.
that the Senate is not a continuing body and makes its rules anew. And 51 senators to support that ruling. And we can change the rules. And the problem is not the filibuster rule, but the fact that it's not changeable, except by overcoming a filibuster.
Right.
And that seems to be pretty clearly violates the Constitution. It's an elementary principle that a legislature can't bind itself into the future. I don't think they can do that unless they make it an issue in the fall.
Yes. Yeah. Whether count me a little skeptical about that as a remedy, but you know what are we looking for remedies for?
The fact that Ben Nelson rules the country.
Yeah.
And the fact that 41 senators can stop all business, and you can elect 41 senators, as I recall, with about 15% of the population.
That's about 15% of the population.
Right. So, I mean, we can't fix the Senate because that's in the Constitution.
Right.
But at least we can make it, you need 50 senators, not 41. So I know I think that would be a huge change in governance.
It would be a huge change in I agree it would be a huge change in governance. But you know, if you go back to the the deficiencies, the troubles go pretty deep. I mean, you didn't need to change the rules to get Medicare through, because even though there were there were these criticisms about Medicare being socialized medicine, the fact is that about 13 Republicans voted for Medicare. So there's something deeply broken about the politics and in the country, and the changes in the rules may help this week, but if the Democrats have 51 majority, not 60, but if they have 51, and the Republicans adopt the same posture that we are going to oppose everything, turn everything into a Waterloo,
mm-hmm.
Then if Ben Nelson is 51 or Joe Lieberman is number 51, then...
Well, but that's not the way. I mean, it looks to me like the Democrats lose 3 or 4 net.
That's this year, I'm looking down the road. I mean, I do think that there is
But I actually think Republican behavior might change if their obstruction were predictably unsuccessful. Right? If they knew the Democrats were eventually going to pass a bill, then the temptation on at least some of them to come over in order to get something they wanted in the bill would be very strong. So I actually think that the rules change would also lead to behavior change. But yeah, and what's changed is not the rules.
I don't think
discipline of the Republicans.
Right. I don't.
And what's striking is that Obama, who's one of the master persuaders of all time, has not made obstruction the issue.
Yeah.
And maybe he will.
Yeah. Well, I think this is I do think one of the things that as we think back about Obama year one, I think one of the things that I'll describe it as a principal failure, although this may feel a little bit like blaming the victim, is that Obama did say that one of the things that he wanted to do was to change the tone of politics.
Right.
And I think whoever is to blame for the tone not changing, you have to count that as a failure.
Right.
And the tone of the politics hasn't changed except for the worse.
Except for the worse, right.
And the problem, I think, with from the point of view of Obama, as I said, this may sound like blaming the victim because, maybe you could say Obama tried, didn't work. The Republicans decided early on that they weren't going to give ground on anything. And there's a huge amount of discipline that they've been able to, impose or work out. And the problem is that I think that Obama didn't have a backup plan. I mean, it's like somebody, it takes two to tango, and then you invite somebody to tango, and they don't want to tango with you, so you get out and you pretend like you can tango by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he had any, view about, change of strategy, no change of strategy yet.
I think we may see that. I mean, my reading of the strategy from the beginning was that both with the Republicans and with the Iranians, his strategy was to look reasonable and either discover that they were prepared to be at least a little bit reasonable or then be in an excellent position to really, fight a good public relations war. And so we may have just been seeing a lot of rope-a-dope, but...
Could be. He's a guy with a lot of patience and a lot of direction, but
part of his problem is that he's the guy who keeps his head when all about him or losing theirs and blaming it on him. I mean, he's got more patience than anybody, unfortunately, including me.
Right.
And so all of us are starting to get impatient with him.
Yeah.
Maybe he's more patient than he should be, or maybe he's got a strategy up his sleeve.
It's an interesting difference. It's possible that he does have a strategy up his sleeve, although, there's a kind of background problem here, which is, you might describe as a kind of creeping Dukakisism. So, it's like Dukakis plus some poetry. So I don't know if you remember 1988, Dukakis is accepting the Democratic nomination. And he says about the election that this election is not about ideology. It's about competence. And mm-hmm. he says this, you know, this is not about old-fashioned, you know, ideas about, you know, liberal and conservative or something like that. It's about outdated.
The L word is leadership. I remember that.
Yeah, it's about accountability. It's right. about responsibility, and it's about respect for truth.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the trouble that I think that Obama has is that there's a mix of very abstract poetry
mm-hmm.
with a kind of Dukakis-style pragmatism. And now, you think of it this way.
Well, I think there are two things that are mixed there, both of which are important.
Yeah.
So one is the pragmatism.
So long as they're both important, I don't care if I mix them.
Right. So one is the sort of doesn't matter what color a cat is as long as it catches mice.
Right.
Pragmatism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the other is process liberalism. Right. A lot of respect for doing things the right way and lawfully and carefully. Right. And part of the reason they're having a problem staffing the administration, of course, is the Republicans are putting holds on everybody.
Right, right.
But part of the problem is they set up such a hypersensitive vetting mechanism
mm-hmm.
that nobody can get through, and it takes forever.
Yeah.
And they've reacted to the fact that they're taking over from a bunch of crooks by tying their own hands.
The thing is, I just want to say this thing about they're taken over from a bunch of crooks. That, you know, true. Okay, that's true. But go back to 1981. So Reagan gets elected, and his popularity sinks over mm-hmm. the first year. And if you look at the correlation between the Reagan decline over the first year and the Obama decline, the correlation is 0.88.
Mm-hmm.
The lines lay on top of each other, you know, a little, but except for the Reagan, you know, Reagan had, not to be morbid about this, but he got a bump from the assassination attempt in, I guess it was March 81.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take out the assassination attempt, it's over 0.9, the correlation. So they're both mm-hmm. sinking as the, because the economy isn't doing well. But now
right.
there are two, but Reagan's first year was not seen as being, you know, problematic, deficient mm-hmm. in some way. And why? And I think there are two reasons. One reason is it's harder to build a healthcare program than it is to deregulate. That's part of
mm-hmm.
it. But there's another thing that I think is really important, and it goes to this issue about the kind of Dukakis-style, excessive emphasis on pragmatism. So what did Reagan do during his first year? He said, as Obama has said, listen, it was a mess when I came in.
Mm-hmm.
Don't blame me for it. It was a mess. But Reagan didn't just say it was a mess when I came in. He mm-hmm. had a theory, an argument mm-hmm. about why
about
it was a mess.
Right.
And if you, what is the Obama administration theory about mm-hmm. why it was
right.
a mess? Have they pushed hard on the view that it was because of deregulation? Well, mm-hmm. you know, it's been. I don't think there is a popular grip on what the view of the Obama administration
right.
is about what was wrong that produced the mess.
Right.
And the issue, I think, about coming back now and you know, changing, being patient, changing direction, having
mm-hmm.
a backup plan when other people aren't tangoing with you is you got to have something to say and. You got to have something to say that you can plausibly say when you have, the Goldman Sachs Treasury Department.
Right.
I think it's going to be tough at this point it's going to take a real change of direction. It's going to take a real change of tone, and I think the place to push back hard at this point, and we'll see if it's possible, is on the with respect to regulation and banks in particular, is about too big to fail, we got a disaster. This is, you know, the Paul Volcker view, it's the Mervyn King view, it's the Henry mm-hmm. Kaufman view, it's even sort of the Alan Greenspan view. It's the Simon Johnson view. The too big to fail is a disaster waiting to happen. That what we've done is socialized risk and privatized gain.
Right. And the bank tax that's proposed is a tax on size and risk, right?
Right.
I mean, I don't know if there's enough there to actually constitute a policy, but I like the politics of it.
I think it's got to be, it has to be about more than, I think it's got to be about more than bonuses.
Well, no, but the tax isn't, they talked about a bonus tax the way the Brits did.
Yeah.
But the tax isn't bonuses at all. Tax is just a straight tax on financial institution operations as a function of size and risk. So it's an anti too big, it's a too big to fail fee.
Yeah. I think
and thank God the Republicans have decided to be against it.
I'm not so sure, thank God, they've decided to be against it, because I think there is, there is sort of it's a kind of an agreement. This is why I mentioned, the Henry Kaufmans and the, Paul Volcker. There's a pretty wide agreement on this. But I think this is, on the politics of this, I think what you need is not just a policy. You got to have an argument. You got to do what Reagan did in the first year. You have to have a story that you're telling people.
Yes, no, that's right.
And this, that's it's right. partly you're giving guidance to policy, but also you're trying to, Reagan successfully, was sort of successful over the longer term in keeping the blame away from him. And I don't think that Obama has been very successful about that. So you need a little bit more. I think the point is you need something more than attractive policies in addition to some, very, very abstract poetry. Mm-hmm. Dukakis was wrong. The election wasn't about competence. It was about ideology.
Right.
And ideology, in a good sense of the term, different principles of, political economic principles are what's at issue. And I think they should push back hard on that.
I mean, to be fair to my friend Mike, 1988 was just about the high water mark of conservative sentiment.
Yeah,
he was just trying to change the conversation. It's not a completely unreasonable thing to do.
Easy in retrospect. Honestly, truth be told, I listened to the speech, and when he said that, I thought, boy, that was a good line.
Mm-hmm.
Until the next day. So no, I understand. I mean, it was not a crazy thing to have done at the time, and it was, but. It was there was something. I also think there was something. There was a political miscalculation. Maybe you just see it in retrospect. But I think there is some predisposition on the Obama side, particularly when it comes to domestic policy, not mm-hmm. global stuff, but domestic policy, to adopt. I think. It's about competence. It's about old-fashioned values of accountability and responsibility and fidelity to the truth, and not about ideology. And again, ideology in the sense that you got an argument, you got an analysis, and you got some principles, and you say we're going to move forward on them, and you have a story about why things have gone badly, and have a story about how you're trying to remedy it and do things differently. And he's tried to do a little bit of that, but I think. There isn't. I don't think he's got a successful picture that he's in the way that Reagan had.
Right, which fits into the other thing that even a committed Kool-Aid drinker like me has to call a failure, mm-hmm. which is that he's not now the leader of a movement.
Yes,
he's the head of government.
That's right.
But the movement's not there, and I expected something different. Now, that may have been an unrealistic expectation. Maybe what they did was the right thing to do. But the fact that he does not have an army loyal to him.
Yeah.
There have been a lot of accomplishments from the liberal point of view of this first year.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not constantly kept before us. And I think part of the problem is the sort of the psychological tendency that leads to political liberalism. Is a tendency toward criticism.
Yeah.
And so, liberals form circular firing squads. And so he's, the Republicans are somewhat successfully obstructing his program.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of being mad at the Republicans, we're getting mad at each other and him.
Yeah.
and that's a shame.
Yeah, I think there's been some of that, although I can, I mean, I think what's happened on the, there's been a bit of that on the healthcare issue, and I think, frankly, Fire Dog Lake has been, you know, trying to organize circular firing squads on this issue. But, you know, I think what's happened with some of the criticism of the healthcare plan, particularly of the Senate healthcare plan, is that, you know, people have pushed back hard on things that were worth, in some cases, pushing back hard on. And but, you know, I don't think, I mean, even Howard Dean, within a few days of saying, you know, defeat this bill, more or less, backed way off on that. Mm-hmm. And I think people were just, you know, people who didn't have any voting power were using whatever rhetorical strengths they had to try to move the bill in the health bill in a better direction. Mm-hmm. So I'm not so sure. You certainly didn't see any circular firing squad among people on the more, you know, on the more liberal end of the Senate. And I think the fact is that everybody knew that the Senate left, such as it is, the Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. Were not going to vote against this thing.
Right.
And it meant that they had no power
right.
Over, you know, not or very little power over the ultimate shape of the bill.
Right.
But, you know, there was a...
But part of what happened, I think,
yeah.
was that because there's a desire in the administration to seem, you know, centrist and postpartisan and
yeah.
stuff,
yeah.
They simply didn't make a big fuss about what a radical bill this is.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the Ezra Klein line, and, you know, Ezra's been studying this stuff carefully and talking to people who, you know, really know it professionally.
Yeah.
This is the biggest transfer of income down the income scale.
Yeah.
Since the New Deal.
Right.
I mean, it's a stunning fact
yeah.
that people on the left are even thinking about being against it because it doesn't have exactly the right public option in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the last thing Obama wants to say at this point when he still needs, you know, Nelson's and Lieberman's vote is, hey, guys, yeah. this is radical.
Yeah.
But, right. but it is.
No, I agree about that, and I think, you know, I've said this in previous blogging ads conversations, and I'll put it in shorthand this time. I mean, I think all of the fuss about the public option was, really almost pure ideology.
I mean, see, my view is the public option was a wonderful thing to trade away for stuff we really cared about,
yeah.
like 400% of poverty rather than 300% of poverty yeah. as the subsidy limit.
Yes. And I think it's not that I think, you know, a big public option or a single payer was a bad idea. I kind of, you know, basically to the extent that I have a grip on the issues, sort of a single payer guy. But to say that it's essential that there be a public option that covers 4 million people, I never really got that, except on the part of people who would say, because it's a stalking horse for a single payer. And then the problem is, as soon as you say that, then the Joe Liebermans of the world come in and say, that's my point. I don't want single payer.
Right.
So it's, you know, a little bit hard to have it both ways. There was something on just on this issue about accomplishments during the first year. That there was something on PolitiFact.com, which has a list of 79 promises that were kept during mm-hmm. the first year. Obama promises, and you know, they're not. I don't want to belittle, you know, the promises that were kept, but you can't run on support increased funding for the NEA, mm-hmm. champion the importance of arts education,
right?
Add another space shuttle flight,
right?
Use the private sector to improve space flight,
right?
You know, weatherizing a million homes per year, not a bad idea.
Right.
But, you know, a lot of these are, you know, even matters of supporting something that hasn't happened. So, you know, there are some real accomplishments. I absolutely agree. But I think you know, not just to state the obvious, we've spent a year of national time on the healthcare issue, mm-hmm. and the failure on that thing is going to make all of this stuff pale by comparison, and the lack of a convincing story about what's happening in the economy, a convincing story explaining both where we were and where we want to go, I think is a problem, and the inability to change the tone of politics, I think, is also a problem. This is getting us dangerously close to having a depressing conversation about the Massachusetts election. And
Where's that?
Hmm?
I never heard of any such election.
Yeah.
I refuse to hear of any such election.
Right. I've been following it pretty closely on mm-hmm. 538. I'll take a stab and say that I think Coakley is going to win by about 3%. But
yeah. Really?
Yeah, yeah. Because mainly because I don't know anything, and so this is like cheap talk for me. This nobody's mm-hmm. going to punish me. I'm not going to lose anything by saying this. But
right.
I think the main thing that makes me think that is, first of all, I think the flow to Brown has been stanched.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, you have this state where essentially the Democrats have been more energized by the total failure, by the worries about Coakley losing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're running, there's a campaign in Massachusetts and there's a lot of passion on both sides, then the Democrats are going to win. And
right.
I think Coakley has not been very, has been the opposite of good at getting any passion going on her side. She's not a very attractive candidate in all sorts of ways. But, you know, I think, people who were not doing anything about the election, people who'd say voted for Capuano in the primary,
mm-hmm.
Have just in the last 48 hours started to get mobilized, and
So my view is, if at this point,
yeah,
if they pulled out Massachusetts by one vote,
yeah,
we dodged a bullet. Everybody's happy. You know, a few chatterers will say, "Well, it shouldn't have even been close in
right.
Massachusetts," and nobody else will care.
Right, I agree about that. But
the stakes are enormous tomorrow.
I completely agree, and I think a bunch of people in Massachusetts have. Gotten that point. Maybe I'm just extrapolating from my own case, which is that I've been sending text messages to my 24-year-old son who lives in Massachusetts, reminding him about voting in the
uh-huh.
election, and it's not something that I usually do.
So, right. Right.
I think there's probably something like that. Anyway, enough depressing news about.
Right.
The first year we haven't even talked about in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Did you expect anything? Did you expect Iraq to look this good a year out?
No, no.
I didn't.
No, I think Iraq is places that are dangerous and unpleasant go, is going reasonably well. I think better than people had anticipated. I think that's it's sort of a bright spot. Unfortunately, the lesson that was learned from Iraq, so you say, okay, what can we learn from this? So what a bunch of people have learned from this is that it was really turned around by the surge. The surge was counterinsurgency. Let's do the same thing in Afghanistan. And that, I think, is really a bad lesson to have learned.
Well, but the other reading is the surge was figuring out that there were important local people in Iraq whose names we didn't know
mm-hmm.
that actually drove things.
Yeah.
And that we needed to deal with them directly. And that seems like probably the right lesson to learn in Afghanistan.
I agree that that lesson is right, and that's the, I mentioned before that, the fixing intel
report from the again, published by the Center for New American Security, but written by these military, DIA, Marine Corps, Army guys. So people know that they have to find out. I mean, this is counterinsurgency. That's what you do in counterinsurgency, is you got to know something about the place in which you're fighting, and you're trying to protect the population. And but whether or not the issue is, there are two issues about Iraq and Afghanistan. The first is, was it really the surge that turned things around? And, well, you know, if you're going to get local, collaborate with local people, the local people have to collaborate. And one different story about what happened in Iraq is that basically before the surge even started, the Sunnis knew that they had lost. And so they were more willing to collaborate with the United States when the surge began, because they already knew that they had been defeated in the Civil War. And it's not clear that there's anything, any comparable dynamic in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. The second thing is...
Did you see this latest poll to come out of Afghanistan?
No.
So somebody did a poll, and this has been done repeatedly, and I don't have it in front of me, sorry, but basically asking a bunch of questions like, you know, how satisfied are you with Karzai? You know, how satisfied were you with the election? Do you think the country's on the right track? Mm-hmm. Karzai's got a better job approval than Obama. Lots more Afghans think that the country is on the right track than on the wrong track.
Mm-hmm.
Support for the Taliban is apparently an all-time low.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the poll numbers, and you wouldn't think that was the catastrophe you were reading about in the newspaper.
I hope the polls are right. I think that the lesson that you describe is the problem with the lesson that you describe, that you gotta, you know,
gotta work the wood with the grain.
Yeah, but that's at 20,000 feet. Actually doing that,
mm-hmm.
actually doing that is really, you know, getting that rubber to meet the road is the tough thing to do. And I think it's really, if you look at this fixing intel report,
mm-hmm.
They're saying there's a. A line early in the thing that describes the distance that needs to be traveled. The United States is focused on insurgent groups. Our intelligence apparatus still finds itself unable to answer fundamental questions about the environment in which we operate and the people we are trying to protect and persuade. So basically, you're starting. These guys, this is, as I say, this isn't a kind of outside critique. This is a self-analysis. It's good. It's a self-analysis, and it says we need to move forward. But what they say is that we are basically starting from zero on doing what is absolutely the essential thing about counterinsurgency. We're starting from zero. And starting from zero not just in terms of how much we know, but starting from zero in terms of the configuration, the organizational configuration for gathering intelligence, and not just gathering it, but as we know from, you know, the Christmas bomber, it's not just important to gather the intelligence, but you got to make sure that it ends up in the right places. So so I agree that that was you're right that that was the lesson that was learned, but whether that should lead you to be optimistic or pessimistic, I think is an open question.
Now, one important change that's been made is that the U.S. government is no longer concentrating on eradicating poppy.
Right.
Those of us who study the drug markets, always thought that was a loser. Proposition. And there's at least some movement toward a broader set of understandings that mostly counter-narcotics efforts increase the amount of money in the narcotics trade and increase the share of that money available to bad guys.
So bad guys provide protection for poppy growers and
for poppy, but it's true for poppy growers, but it's also true for refiners and exporters.
Yeah.
So it would seem obvious that the fact that Afghanistan pays its border guards $1 a day and therefore collects essentially no revenue, right? It seems obvious that you ought to strengthen that, that you ought to pay them better and train them better and, you know, it's just they do their work. But if you think about what that means for the drug trade or for any kind of smuggling, it means that you're going to increase the price gradient across the border. You're going to make it harder to smuggle,
right?
Which means more profitable for the people who can do it. And the people who can do it are people like the Taliban and the warlords.
Right. Or people who have the protection from the Taliban.
Yeah,
so you can increase the protection, the price that people pay you for protection.
Right. So you can give the protection providers a larger share of a larger market.
Yeah.
And that's even beyond the sort of obvious fact that when you do what we've done over the last 5 years and bragged about, which is eliminate poppy growing in most of Afghanistan. Most of Afghanistan is now poppy free, which sounds like an accomplishment until you translate that into we have given Taliban-controlled areas a monopoly in the world poppy crop.
Right.
So that's in the process of being undone, and that could matter.
Which brings us to another topic. I mean, we've segued into your favorite topic, drugs and crime.
Right.
You focus more principally on the domestic side of this.
Correct.
And so what you just described was the logic of arguments about drug decriminalization.
At the extreme, sure.
Yeah, right.
Sure.
So the
disadvantage of keeping some drugs illegal is that you provide economic opportunities for crime.
Right. And particularly for people who are for violent crime and for people who are specialized in violence and can provide protection services.
Note that that's not exclusive to prohibitions. Right, one of the big sources of terrorist finance in Europe is cigarette smuggling.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because any regulation and any tax that's big enough to actually change behavior creates that same opportunity for successful profitable evasion.
But you have a different view about what to do on the kind of drugs crime issues in the United States, not decriminalizing drugs.
No, though paying attention to where your enforcement generates opportunities, right? So, our biggest foreign drug problem, of course, is Mexico, right? We've got enormous stakes in Mexican stability. And the war between the Mexican government and the drug trafficking organizations in northern Mexico is really at catastrophic levels.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's generated partly because we do such a good job of making it hard to smuggle cocaine directly from Colombia to South Florida through the Caribbean. It was that change in the early 80s that created the Central American and Mexican route. Mexico never had a share of the cocaine business.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe we should think about undoing that. The problem is that the general enforcement mindset, the war on drugs mindset, is that, well, we look at the flows and we figure out where we can stop them.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a market perspective and say, well, look, the volume of the flow is really determined by the demand in the U.S. and the distribution networks in the U.S.
Right.
And then all you get to choose is where the flow is. If you think this is a problem in flood control, and you just want to get the water to go through its least harmful channel.
Right.
Right. But that requires stepping away from the we're going to have a drug-free society. And so I think certainly the new sounds that are coming out of the drug czar's office are very different from the old sounds. To go back to your earlier point, this is one of the cases where competence and respect for truth are actually operating principles that matter.
I think competence is good. I think accountability, responsibility, and respect for the truth are all good. I just they only take you so far.
Right.
But say more though about what your picture is about more successful ways of dealing. So we got this. So just backing up a step, we got this mass incarceration problem.
Right.
A lot of people in jail. You know the answer to this. You can fill in the blank here. N% of them are in jail for drug-related stuff. I'm guessing about 50. I don't know.
No. I wish.
120. No.
No, it's about 20%.
20%.
2.4 million behind bars.
Yeah.
About half of those are on drug charges. Now, yeah. Other people are there for the crimes they committed to buy their drugs.
Yeah.
But no, it's not the case that nonviolent drug sellers are crowding our prisons, and it's certainly not the case that non-criminal drug users are crowding our prisons. That's just not right. But there are, there are things you can do, right? So you've got mass incarceration of drug dealers.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that's a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you put a burglar in prison, you reduce the number of burglaries.
Mm-hmm.
Simply mechanically by keeping him from committing any.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no social force that leads somebody else to do his burglaries for him.
Mm-hmm.
If you put a crack dealer in prison, you just make a niche for another crack dealer. So even if you think, as I do, that we need drug laws, including prohibitions,
mm-hmm.
the case for locking up a drug dealer really needs to be a pretty specific case about why you want him not dealing. The notion that you're locking up drug dealers just to sort of discourage drug dealing doesn't work very well.
But you are locking up that person because you're trying to discourage drug dealing.
But that doesn't work in the face of a market. So what we've demonstrated is we're now locking up 15 times as many cocaine dealers
mm-hmm.
as we were in 1980, and the price of cocaine has fallen by 90%. So the attempt to raise drug prices by putting a lot of drug dealers in jail just didn't work. And I'm convinced that we could have the number of drug dealers in prison and not change the drug abuse problem at all. So that's an easy one. It doesn't get you very far because it's only 20% of the incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those 500,000 people did something else you really want them in prison for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's some illusion here. Some of those people went away because it was the drug dealing you could easily get them on. They were actually the leader of the local street gang.
Right.
But with a 5-year crack mandatory minimum,
why you don't like mass incarceration. I mean, not to
correct. I don't like mass incarceration.
2.4 million people in jail, that's a bad thing.
That's a very bad thing.
Really bad thing. And bad thing in various ways. It's really costly.
Actually, that's the one way it isn't very bad.
Uh-huh.
Though that's the strong political argument. I mean, at the state level, the budgetary pressures created by the prison boom are helping fight the further expansion of prisons. Last year was the first year in 40 that the prison population did not go up noticeably. But the total cost of the prison budget in the U.S. is about $50 billion. Out of a $13 trillion economy, that's the rounding error. I mean, policing is what's expensive.
Yeah, I mean, when I say costs, I don't mean just the cost of prisons.
Right.
I mean the cost of the strategy of mass incarceration.
Right. The human costs are enormous.
The human costs, that's what I mean.
And it's hard to get people to care about that.
Yeah.
Right.
So, it is very hard to get people to care about it.
As white-collar criminals start to go to prison again, there's suddenly a lot more people who are worried about prison conditions.
Right. So you think so? You don't like mass
incarceration. Corruption cases.
Right. So you don't like mass incarceration, and you think that there are alternatives to incapacitation,
right.
Which is what imprisonment is. Effective alternatives to incapacitation as a way to reduce mass incarceration and also reduce crime.
Right. So my conviction is we could have half as much crime and half as many people in prison 10 years from now as we have today, doing stuff we already know how to do. We're back to the public management problem.
Right. And so my understanding about your view on this is that what we already know how to do that would, as just to repeat what you're saying, this isn't cheap talk on your part. You could be held accountable for this in 10 years, because this is your business. In 10 years, we could reduce the get the number of people in prison down close to a million from almost 2.5 million, and we could cut the crime rate in half. And as I understand it, the strategy for doing that is that you focus enforcement resources more effectively. So basically, to get people out of prison, what you need to do is rely more heavily on
Community corrections,
on community stuff, which is probation and parole,
right, and bail and other pretrial release, which is the one nobody ever pays any attention to. I discovered in the course of doing my book that there is no estimate of the number of bailees in the United States. Mm-hmm. We don't know how many people are currently awaiting trial, mm-hmm. and yet those people account for about 10% of all new crimes. So if we can get a handle on the offenders we know about, mm-hmm. who aren't behind bars, then we can have less crime and less incarceration.
And getting a handle on them means
greater
certainty of quick costs if you do something bad. Is that
right?
That's the summary.
Right. Greater certainty of quick cost if you do something bad, and in order to do that, you have to reduce the severity. Right, so currently, a probation or parole revocation leads to 3 or 6 or 9 or 12 months in prison, or more than that. You need a situation where not showing up for the meeting with your probation officer or showing up and testing dirty for methamphetamine leads to 2 days in jail right now. Mm-hmm. And the Hope Project NOI demonstrates that, you know, hardcore long-term methamphetamine users can and will stop under that pressure, even if they're not required to go to formal treatment.
So here's, the skeptic.
So that's the community corrections part. Then there's the policing part.
Right.
Which is learning how to make threats do the job. And that's, you know, David Kennedy's been demonstrating that in various places.
So the skeptic in me says, so you have high certainty of a low severity, quickly imposed cost for any kind of bad. You do something a little bit bad, you're going to get whacked. You're not going to get whacked hard, but you're going to get whacked fast. And why doesn't this just become, maybe I'm just thinking of the drug stuff for now, but why isn't this just the cost of doing business? So you're going to spend 2 days in jail if you come in dirty. Okay. All right.
Well, if you're thinking about a dealer,
yeah,
it's just the cost of doing business. Mm-hmm. If you think about somebody who's a methamphetamine user,
mm-hmm.
right, that'll change behavior, it turns out.
And it'll change.
He's not in business. He's just having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not as if most methamphetamine or crack or heroin users really like that. You know, if you ask them, you know, do you wish you'd never started, they'll say yes.
Mm-hmm.
They regard their use as a problem. It's just they lack the self-command, as most of us do, to resist a brief, very intense pleasure that happens right now,
mm-hmm.
because of a fear of a vague consequence that might happen sometime off in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So this is basically applying behavioral economics,
mm-hmm.
To this problem. And it turns out that you can make a lot of change with small incentives if they're delivered correctly.
So let me just back up a step now. So you think we can get the number of people in prison down from 2.4 million to 1.2 million. To be precise,
we've got 1.7 million in prison and 700,000 in jail.
Right.
But that 2.4 could be 1.2.
Okay, the 2.4 could be 1.2. You got it from 2.4 to 1.2 by having high certainty, low severity, quickly imposed costs for bad behavior, and
for people who are on probation or parole. So basically,
right.
You make probation and parole a more effective alternative to incarceration, and you massively substitute that for actual incarceration.
Right.
So who are actually behind bars are the ones who wouldn't behave themselves under that circumstance.
Right. So what you've done is you've vastly increased the number of people who are out in the community on probation, parole.
No. We've already got 5 million people on probation and parole compared to the 2.4 million behind bars.
Yeah. But we don't
need more people on probation and parole. We just have to watch the ones we have better.
But if you
reduce the number.
Let a million people out of prison
so
and jail.
So you just increased by 20%.
20%, exactly.
You've increased by 20%,
right.
And that's all I meant by
right.
the increase. Okay, so you've increased by 20%, but now and now it looks like you've got so you have this population that's not being managed very well now. Probation and parole are not very effectively implemented now in terms
right.
of keeping people out of jail. So what you do is you change the treatment of that population. That's you change how the probation parole population is treated. And one of the things that you do is you keep those people, you make this an effective alternative to incarceration so that these are people who are not just regularly going back into jail. And the way you do that is you target the resources on some small subset of that now 6 million people. I guess I'm not, so you can, you've told
oh,
us.
No. You start with a small subset.
Right.
And once you've got them under control, they're not very much effort to keep under control.
Mm-hmm.
And you just expand that until, hope, probation, right, the system in Hawaii, started with 35 people.
Yeah.
It's now 1,500.
Mm-hmm.
If the plans are met, it'll soon be 3,000. There are only 8,000 felony probationers on the whole island. So eventually HOPE turns from being a program to being part of routine probation or parole supervision. And the logic of it is that if you get the violation rates down, you can afford to do this tight monitoring because you're not actually whacking people very much. The capacity to whack people is always scarce.
Right.
And the trick
but in equilibrium, so to speak, you're not using it very much. That's
correct.
The theory.
You're trying to move from a bad equilibrium to a good equilibrium.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced that the offenders will respond if you can get the officials to do their job.
Right.
And that's still an open question.
So the big piece here, and but there being neither time nor world to pursue it, so we've been going for a while, you've told a methamphetamine story about why getting whacked for 2 days is really a bad thing, and it's I assume it's partly a story about the fact that you're a drug user and you don't want to be sitting in jail for a couple of days and have no access to drugs. So there are two issues. One is how do you move that from a story about methamphetamine users to a story about people who are doing burglary.
I think the answer is nobody wants to spend 2 days in jail when he could be partying. And if it's going to happen right now, that'll be a reason not to do whatever you were otherwise going to do. And if you can keep them from methamphetamine use, right, which is what they were doing the burglaries to pay for, it turns out you can cut down. So doing this drug testing in Hawaii cut the new arrest rate by 50%. Just that. And how much you could add to that if you did position monitoring as well, I don't know, but I suspect quite a lot.
So, I think we'll have to say to be continued.
Yeah. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah. I mean, it goes, there's an old, there's a very nice line in Jeremy Bentham's Introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation.
Mm-hmm.
He says, punishment in itself is an evil. Meaning,
great man, Jeremy.
Yeah, and meaning not that you shouldn't punish anybody, but
right.
you better have a pretty good reason for doing
right.
it.
Right.
And a summary of the kind of sensibility behind mass incarceration is that people have kind of lost the sense that punishment in itself is an evil.
Exactly. So that's the first principle I try to argue for in the book, that punishment. I mean, I'm not a not a 19th century moral philosopher, I was trained more or less in economics. So my version of that is punishment is always a cost, never a benefit.
Yeah, that's right.
And that turns out to be something you can actually sell to people, at least now, partly because crime's down. They're not as afraid.
Yeah, well, I think that's a large issue to get away from thinking of punishment in terms of what bad people deserve.
Right.
And to think of it as, and Bentham said in evil, what he means by evil is pain. So
right.
he means by evil what you mean by cost.
Right, exactly.
And he's wondering, like, is it profitable? This is
mm-hmm.
a kind of question that's kind of, we've sort of lost track of, and I'm glad you're
right.
getting us back on the right track. It was good to talk, Mark.
Josh, a great pleasure.
Talk to you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.